Ahoj, já jsem Honza z Prahy. Protože cestujeme s Rikem, tak cestujeme v prvé řadě po hospodách. Tak dáte si pivo? This was Czech and it means hi, my name is Honza, I'm from Prague. And since we are traveling with Rick, we are traveling mainly through the pubs. Will you have a beer with me? Ahoj, já jsem Honza z Prahy. Protože cestujeme s Rikem, tak cestujeme v prvé řadě po hospodách. Tak dáte si pivo?
I'm a big believer in the more understanding you pack along in your travels, the more you'll get out of your trip. And especially when venturing beyond our country in Europe, I find enjoying a book chosen to enhance my understanding can really help. Before heading out on a trip, that's what David Damrosch loves to do. He explores what great authors have written about the place he's visiting. As chair of the Department of Comparative Literature at Harvard University, David put together a list of 80 works that he recommends. Contemporary and classic writers who are the best at making foreign worlds come alive for us. He's written a kind of guide to this. It's called Around the World in 80 Books. And David joins us now for some advice on a few great books that can help make distant lands, distant cultures come alive, even if just traveling vicariously from your own living room. David, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
So you have an appetite for travel, as I do, and I love the way you reference the first movie you ever saw, and you were just a little toddler, and you saw Jules Verne's book in a movie form, Around the World in 80 Days. What's your memory of that, and what kind of an impact did that have on you?
Well, I think it was one of the first, you know, widescreen panorama projections, and it's so vast, the landscape that you get through the film. And I was this little kid growing up in Maine. I'd never been outside of the state of Maine, as far as certainly not at that age. And suddenly there's this whole world that you can see. So that was really a jolt for me in a very positive way.
Now, your book is Around the World in 80 Books, and it's broken into chapters, 15 or 16 chapters, each hitting a destination. And of course, you've got European destinations and Western destinations. But for me, the real challenge is breaking out of our culture. I guess I'm just pretty ethnocentric when I come to what I can relate to. And any time I can get an inkling of a rich culture through its literature that is totally outside of the West, Africa, Asia, Islam, to me, it is so rewarding. And what is sort of emblematic of that is when I was in Iran, I went to Shiraz, and there they have the tombs of the great poets. And these are like religious figures, I think, for the people of Iran. And to see people gathering on the birthdays of these poets and going on dates and reading poetry on the tomb of Hafez, or, you know, the local equivalents of Rumi. It's just an inspiration, but it's kind of out of reach for me. I know that you have a section on Hafez and the poets of Shiraz. How do we make that within reach?
Well, I think translations are very important for this. A really great translation with a good introduction can do a lot. So there's a wonderful translator, Dick Davis, and the collection is called Faces of Love, Hafez and the Poets of Shiraz. He carefully picks three poets and selects from those the poems he thinks will speak best to us. He translates them brilliantly, and he has a nice introduction, and it's a delightful, delightful book. It's not like studying. It's like, love poetry from these people. And one of them is an obscene poet, and one of them is a woman poet. Very interesting. So you get a whole different sense in what you might think from the news items about Iran today. In my own case, going to Shiraz a few years ago, my host took my wife and me there to the tomb of Hafez, along with his daughter-in-law, who is a physician, and she starts reciting poems from memory. And it was just like, this is really coming to life.
You know, you said translated brilliantly. How do you know it was translated brilliantly?
That's a very interesting question. One thing you can do with a work that's been translated often is you can compare translations. And you can sort of see, now, which is a translation for me? There's not even necessarily only one best one, but which speaks to me? Which do I feel at home in? And I felt that very much with these translations of Hafez. Mm.
It's like different versions of the Bible. Now there's all sorts of different translations of the Bible, and some are in, you know, 21st century street language, and others are in Old English and so on. And I guess you just got to find the language, that the translation that works for you.
Yeah, and I'm a great believer in the pleasure principle. If I pick up a book and start it and it's just not speaking to me, then I'll pick up a different book. There's lots of other books in the world.
So the choice of the book is important, and you're going to invest many hours into it, and the potential for really having it have an impact on you is huge. And the other choice is what translation you're going to choose. And that would deserve a little bit of shopping around before you commit.
It can. If it's a 20th century work, you may have only one choice, and that's fine. Or if you just, you'll hear about it. I mean, I'm also a great believer in word of mouth. I mean, a lot of my favorite books, someone put it in my hand and said, you've got to read this. And that's a good way. I also want to underscore that for me, literature is a really privileged mode of access to very distant times and places. And I work a lot on ancient literature. And one of the things that I like to find is work that really makes you feel at home. And the most distant thing that can speak to us, just give an ancient Egyptian example. Here's a stanza from an Egyptian poem from maybe 3,000 years ago. A man is saying to himself, why need you hold converse with your heart? To embrace her is all my desire. Now he's speaking to the girl. As Amun lives, I come to you, my loincloth on my shoulder. I think we can sort of relate to that. Another poem, the woman sings, I found my lover at the ford, his feet set on the water. He builds a table there for feasts and sets it out with beer. He brings a blush to my skin, for he is tall and lean.
You know, I'm just curious because you're so steeped in higher education and this kind of high thinking. What do you feel like the priorities in our society are doing these days in education? Because I feel like there's a lot of pressure to have us all become well-trained for a career, you know, vocational training, basically, at the expense of liberal arts and literature and history and so on. Do you feel like there's any tug-of-war going on in our society, or are people just bailing on one value and investing in the other?
Well, I think there's always been a tendency this way. Wordsworth, he talks in the preface to the second edition of Lyrical Ballads that, oh, there's all this junk literature people are reading now. The works of Shakespeare being overwhelmed. No one's reading Shakespeare anymore. They're just reading these sickly and stupid German tragedies that are coming over, the equivalent of, you know, bad things on Netflix, I guess. There's always that worry. And I think that, I mean, my responsibility as a teacher is to say, look, these works are really good. Read these. Spend time with them. And our students really respond to it. I think people have a hunger for just slowing up, thinking a little bit, and just basking in the pleasures of a great work of literature.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're speaking with literary historian David Damrosch, and he founded Harvard University's Institute for World Literature. And he's with us today to recommend some of the greatest writing about many places that he profiles in his book, Around the World in 80 Books. It's his compilation of 80 exceptional books, classics and contemporary, from authors who shape our idea of the world through literature. So, David, let's just talk very briefly about these different corners of the planet and how literature might open us up to things. Let's talk about sub-Saharan Africa. What a diverse and fascinating story that has been, I think, almost intentionally underappreciated. We have diminished it, and it's compounded by the challenge that there's not a lot published in sub-Saharan Africa. What is a way that we can remedy that in our reading?
Yes, so I think to find what there is, which is already a lot and more than any one person can probably read, and to sort of see the dialogue that these writers have with each other. So Africans are quite tired of being told about their society from outside, of which a classic that I discuss is Joseph Conrad's brilliant novella, Heart of Darkness, which is a wonderful exploration of what it's like for a European to be in a totally foreign era. But then Chinua Achebe, great writer, mid-century, writes an essay on racism in Heart of Darkness. And he says, you know, the Africans have no voice. He's well-meaning, he's anti-imperialistic, but look, he's repeating the worst aspect of the empire, that there's no human being at the other side. So he rewrites it. And then contemporary writer Chimamanda Adichie, wonderful Nigerian-American writer, rewrites Things Fall Apart in her story, The Thing Around Your Neck. And she gives it now a much more strong feminist aspect and much more contemporary than Achebe. But if you read Achebe and Adichie, you get already a stereoscopic view. I also think that we who are studying these things have to be kind of activists. One of the works I include is an amazing work by a Congolese novel called Jean-Baptiste Vico, or Le Viol du Corps Africain, Jean-Baptiste Vico, or The Rape of African Discourse. And he's very much concerned with this European perspective taking over. But it was never translated because he's making fun of the Africanists. He's making fun of the Europeans. It was published in 75. But 15 years ago, I said, this book really needs to be translated. So finally I decided, well, no one's going to do it. I better put my time where my mouth is. So I have now just translated. It's coming out in the spring in a bilingual edition.
And you've got five books that are worth knowing about in your chapter that covers sub-Saharan Africa. Latin America, I think we're pretty ethnocentric in our own hemisphere, and there's lots going on south of our border. What would you recommend there?
I'm a big fan of the greatest 19th century novelist in Brazil, whose name is Machado de Assis, Joaquim Maria Machado de Assis. And he was a fascinating character. He's mixed race, part African, part European descent, grows up in utter poverty, and is a genius. He starts publishing when he's 15. He becomes the most important novelist of the century in Brazil. He founds the Brazilian Academy of Letters. And this wonderful satirical novel, The Posthumous Memoirs of Brás Cubas. The hero has died and is writing his memoirs after his death. And it's satirical, it's hilarious, and it's a deep dissection of the tensions of Brazil moving into independence in the 19th century. It's absolutely wonderful and has been retranslated recently very well.
That sounds fascinating. If you are fortunate enough to travel to any of these rich corners of the planet, it's almost a shame not to have a little context given to you by some great and thoughtfully chosen literature. Of course, China is the emerging giant on the planet. What is your advice for better understanding China through literature?
There's the most important woman writer of the 20th century in China named Eileen Chang. Wonderful collection of short stories called Love in a Fallen City, beautifully translated by Karen Kingsbury. The title story is an amazing thing set in Japanese occupied period in World War II. Contemporary writer Mo Yan, Nobel Prize winner, fantastic novel, Life and Death Are Wearing Me Out. He's reincarnated several times as different animals. And each time is another decade in modern Chinese history from 1950 to 2000, where he's reborn finally as millennium baby and the new century can begin. It's satirical and it's moving and it's absolutely wonderful.
David Damrosch is joining us from his home studio in Brooklyn right now on Travel with Rick Steves. David teaches comparative world literature at Harvard, where he's also the director of the Institute for World Literature. During the pandemic lockdown, David turned his armchair travels into his own literary guide. It's called Around the World in 80 Books. David's book is designed to help us explore some 80 contemporary and classic writers and to make the worlds they write about come alive in our imaginations. David, I was going to go through a couple more regions around the planet, but what I'd like to do is instead go back in time, because I know you have a real affinity for and appreciation for ancient sources. And as a tour guide and a travel writer, I have a real passion for helping people get themselves in the mindset of somebody who lived and worked and did great things centuries ago that we tend to underestimate. What is an example of some ancient literature that you would find both accessible and really helpful in giving us an appreciation of civilizations from a time that we might underestimate them?
Well, the greatest novel ever written by a woman any time in the history of literature is The Tale of Genja by Murasaki Shikibu. Not saying anything against Virginia Woolf or George Eliot, whom I adore, but Murasaki is amazing, amazing, amazing.
So say that again. That's a new name for a lot of us.
So the author's name is Murasaki, uh-huh. Shikibu, The Tale of Genji, G-E-N-J-I, written 1,000 years ago in Kyoto. And you can still go to temples there that are from that era. And she's telling the story of a prince, a shining prince, Genji, and all the women in his life. And it's filled with poetry. And it really gives you a feel of aspects of Japanese culture that you absolutely feel today. Hmm. One of the other writers, I talk about Higuchi Uchiyo, who is the most important woman writer of the late 19th century in Japan, identified very closely with Murasaki. And indeed, when she sells her first story, she's a poor kid in Tokyo on the edge of the red light district. She sells a story for like the equivalent of a couple of bucks to a popular magazine. Her sister says, oh, you'll be a famous writer. One day your picture will be on a banknote. She says, oh, come on, get out of it. Well, her picture is now on the 5,000 yen banknote. She's the third woman ever, the other whom was an empress, and Murasaki Shikibu.
Whoa, what an accomplishment. You know, and you mentioned Kyoto 1,000 years ago. When I was in Kyoto, I had this sense that this is a marvelous, sophisticated, flowery, fragrant, fun-loving, elegant society, but I didn't know how to get my brain around it. I just had this strong feeling that I was walking through a town that 1,000 years ago was every bit as exciting as it is today. Give me a concrete example of how this book you mentioned that's written 1,000 years ago can take you back in time in Japan.
Yes, it's very much about how particularly women are making a place for themselves in a very patriarchal society and in a world where walls are made out of paper. Everyone hears and gossips about what everything else is happening. So it's a little bit like the blogosphere or the internet now. There's no real privacy. It's very refined, as you say, very aesthetic. And just on the surface, there's this oppression and violence in all sorts of directions and people maneuvering, jockeying for position everywhere. So it's not necessarily that different from what's happening in the Japanese parliament today at a different level. And at the same time, you really feel that they have this deep sense of the transience of life. There's a wonderful moment, Genji's love of his life, who's also named Murasaki, the author takes her pen name from the name of her heroine. She dies, and Genji thinks, oh, I wanted to live with her 1,000 years, but that cannot happen in life. That's the great sad truth. Well, Murasaki died 1,000 years ago, but the tale of Genji lives on 1,000 years later.
Oh, you know, I love the way you bring out these sort of timeless truths and insights that we can gain through literature, and how there's, more often than not, applications to our life and our challenges and our confusion today to draw upon to try to wrestle with challenges we have today emotionally and philosophically and intellectually.
Yeah, I think the great thing about literature, it helps us see ourselves from outside, which is so hard to do otherwise.
And that's a great thing about travel. I mean,
totally.
I believe that you actually learn more about your own homeland by leaving it and looking at it from a distance. And I suppose with literature, we can do something along the same
and
lines.
And often the two at once. So one of my authors is James Baldwin, who's often thought of as one of the great African-American writers, but he writes all of his major work in France. He's looking back at America from that distance, and he couldn't have done it otherwise.
David Damrosch, thank you for writing this and your passion to inspire us to take advantage of literature to get more out of our travels and to actually enjoy some travels sometimes without even leaving home. The book is Around the World in 80 Books. Thanks again, David.
Thank you, Rick.
Those faraway places I've been reading about in a book that I took from a shelf.
Have you ever written about the world you see in a short haiku poem? Here's some examples of what our listeners are writing. They sent in their travel haiku from a link at ricksteves.com/radio.
Babette Salas from Springfield, Illinois, updates a haiku she sent us several years ago to mention the Global Soap Project. It's a collaboration between hotels and an agency that promotes public health in the developing world by bringing soap to the people who need it. Her first poem read, "Tiny hotel soap, too small to wash my body, still I'll take you home." Now, she says, "Tiny hotel soap, first I bathe, then you're off to Global Soap Project." Jeffrey Staley of Bothell, Washington, paints this portrait of the view from his window seat on a flight from Boston to Seattle. "Cloud pearls curl proudly above Lake Superior. Water winks below." While Pamela Wilding from San Rafael, California, turned this common flight experience into a poem. "Our flying tin lands. Sardine passengers await a can opener."
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. I'm the executive producer, Tim Tatton, assisted by associate producers Casmara Hall and Donna Bardsley. Our website is managed by Andrew Wakeling. Our theme music was written and performed by Jerry Frank. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Thanks to Keith Sticklemeyer for reading this week's travel haiku. We'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.